Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling. Special midweek edition of the podcast because I won't be available this weekend to either record or publish. So as a result, we're giving you an early one this week, and then we'll be back to the regular weekend schedule next week. Now, coming up on today's show, one of our favorite interviews perhaps of all time, we talked to Alan Payne, who oversaw one of the most successful Blockbuster franchise chains in the country, wrote a book that was just released yesterday on Amazon and through other bookstores. It's called Built to Fail. It chronicles Blockbuster's growth in the late 80s and early 90s, all the way to their eventual bankruptcy. Now, Alan's final store, or Border Entertainment's final store that he oversaw, closed just recently in 2018. So he'll talk about some of the differences between the corporate Blockbuster stores, the franchise stores, and ultimately what did Blockbuster in? Let me give you a hint. It's not Netflix, that part, a bit of revisionist history, if you will. We'll also look ahead to, well, the pandemic and states releasing mask mandates here over the next few months. But first, we begin with news. And after looking ahead at sporting goods retail last week, we felt that it was only right to cover Dick's Sporting Goods fourth quarter earnings this week. Before we get into Dick's, a reminder that you can rate us however you access us. Those ratings help others to find us, is the obligatory pre-show mention here. You can also check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. Layton just posted a picture from the last Orange County Sears that is going out of business on those platforms. Now, Dick's earnings come in this week after Hibbett Sports, I mentioned last week, revealed an earnings beat. They had some superb same-store sales numbers, did Hibbett, but forecasts were a little bit middle of the road. Now, during the post-opening portion of the pandemic, Dick's in particular has seen sales success as people continue to flock outdoors and towards activities. Remember, a lot of their stores were closed March through May, and yet still they look to be up on revenue for the year. Their recent initiatives have largely been focused on private label products and strengthening partnerships with the likes of Nike and Reebok. And additionally, they've mentioned aiming to increasingly localize stores to make better use of their square footage, removing, let's say, a larger selection of hunting gear from certain stores, as an example, to make a greater product selection available in more successful product lines. So those are kind of the things Dick's has talked about as a backdrop to this quarter. Now let's talk briefly about the numbers. Analysts came in with consensus estimates of earnings of $2.21 per share. Dick's beat that with earnings per share of $2.43. Now, this was hindered somewhat by charges of 38 cents per share related to compensation and safety costs surrounding COVID. Don't worry, though, their company's margins still plenty healthy, way up over 2019 for 2020 as a whole. We'll talk about those in a second. However, as with Hibbett, it was those same store sales that got a significant year-over-year boost. For Dick's, the number came in at 19.3% year-over-year. Overall net sales were up 19.8% versus last year's fourth quarter. This resulted in a record-breaking fourth quarter in terms of revenue. The robust comps produced another record for Dick's as well at 9.9% full-year same-store sales increase, or 9.9% full-year same-store sales increase. This happened despite closures and, as we mentioned, soft sales at the onset of the pandemic and the cancellation of many spring sports seasons for youth. Team sports is a major category for Dick's. They persevered through all of that to have their greatest year-over-year sales increase, at least on a comp basis, in the company's history. Part of that was online sales. They continued to leverage up for Dick's with e-commerce penetration 32% of total sales in Q4. Last year, this number was 25% of sales. And for the year, Dick's saw a 100% increase in e-commerce sales. Although this number was greater in Q2 and Q3 than it was in Q4, e-com sales for the most recent quarter rose just 57% year over year. I say just, that's a number they would have been doing backflips over a year ago. And it's still positive for them, of course. But like I said, nowhere near the numbers you saw from them early in the pandemic. In-store and curbside, by the way, was up 250% over last year for the quarter. Stores, by the way, fulfilled over 70% of online sales. And the company did suggest on this call that brick and mortar was here to stay for them. In fact, they're seeking to expand their brick and mortar footprint going into the 2021 calendar year. Now, new CEO Lauren Hobart joined the call to provide some color to their sales figures. She actually noted significant growth in their three primary merchandise categories, so growth across the board. For them, they divide it into hardlines, apparel, and footwear. But she spent a decent amount of time talking about private labels, or what they call vertical brands. Now, vertical brands brought them over $1.3 billion in sales during the entirety of 2020. Comps outperformed the average product by 400 basis points when you look at their vertical brands. Part of that is because of product development. Part of that is because of gaining momentum and just increased product over product comps there. Now, vertical brands for them now make up their largest brand in the golf area, fitness category as well, outdoor equipment, and team sports. And they want to give the vertical brands yet more floor space in 2021. And if you're a longtime listener of the podcast, you'll note that we mentioned that they expanded that previously in 2019. We talked about it when they were expanding it in 2019. They want to give yet more floor space to these vertical brands, again, which are not only driving sales, as is evident by the numbers, but also driving margins. By the way, they're rolling out a new brand, Burst, later this month, and that's designed to market to what they call the modern athletic male, if you will. So on their earnings presentation, lots of pictures of athletic males, I guess, surrounding that brand. Now, they did release guidance for their next fiscal year as well, as Hibbett did. Dick's released comp expectations in the low negative single digits to low positive single digits for next year. And although this doesn't appear as though it echoes those growth sentiments we discussed in last week's Looking Ahead segment, these projections do include some important caveats for Dick's. Most notably, they don't account for any potential stimulus activity whatsoever. An additional wave of stimulus checks, which again appear likely at the point of recording this podcast, that would significantly positively impact their expectations, though they didn't give us an idea on the call of exactly how much it would improve their first and second quarters. Now, one thing we did bring up in Looking Ahead last week was mentioned on the call, and that was team sports. They're going to be lapping a year in which most team sports, especially in the spring, were canceled. So that's going to help sales numbers, at least in this category. But Hobart did say that they expect demand to be significant, even when compared to past years, due to the pent-up nature of this demand. Additionally, they're reworking their soccer team sport offerings with a greater focus on premium product. This is something they did with great effect with baseball. If you've been in a Dick's store over the last couple of years, you'll notice that their team sports section in terms of baseball really built out. It's pretty substantial, even around me. I'm in Colorado Springs, and you don't think of that necessarily as a baseball hotbed. It is a reasonably popular sport, but there are other sports that usually take focus away. However, the Dick's here, such a large portion of their second floor devoted to baseball and team baseball. Now, soccer, of course, they're doing this with soccer. That's the fastest growing youth sport in the U.S., and that's according to ESPN data from just before the pandemic. At the time that data was run, it was the fourth most popular youth sport overall. But you look in a lot of markets, and soccer here in Colorado Springs, again, insanely popular, yet lags behind in terms of square footprint in their stores and also in terms of diversity of products. So they want to bring more premium products in there. They want to focus more service surrounding the soccer team sport aspect of it. They feel like they can drive both traffic and sales by doing that. Now, back to their 2021 expectations as a whole, they did something interesting in comparing their expectations. They used 2019 as the comp year rather than 2020, calling 2020 essentially an anomaly. In any case, they do expect sales, even without any further stimulus activity, to inch up 2% over 2020. So that's net sales versus comp store sales. That's an 11% increase over 2019. And they do expect margins to go down somewhat. Income before income taxes was 7.4% of net sales in 2020. That's one of their best numbers since we've been tracking the retailer over the last 6 to 7 years. It was 4.7% in 2019, to put it in perspective. So they are seeing it go down from last year, but up in terms of their average year. This next year, they're seeing in the high 5% range in terms of their margins before income taxes. So basically right between 2019 and 2020. And perhaps the most interesting thing was regarding their projections as far as their store footprint is concerned. No projected store closures were mentioned on the call for the 2021 fiscal year. There are, however, 11 relocations planned. This is a positive. You've got to think, based on the plus performances of their relocations in years past, and honestly, based on the performances of relocated spots and stores for most retailers in the past. Additionally, they expect to open 6 new Dick's stores and 6 specialty concept stores. No word on whether that's specific to their public lands concept, which they're switching over certain stores to, or their off-price concept Overtime, which they've been using basically some rehashed real estate and some abandoned real estate by other retailers to backfill. Again, off-price concept, and per Dick's, it seemed to be doing relatively well immediately after their launch of those concepts. Well, that'll do it for our news segment of the show. Coming up, once again, Alan Payne oversaw a successful Blockbuster franchise chain in Border Entertainment. He wrote the book Built to Fail, out on Amazon as of yesterday. He'll be joining us right after this. We get quite a few requests from listeners to discuss defunct retailers, their path to one-time glory, and their eventual descent. And perhaps no retailer's decline was more notable in the early 2000s than that of Blockbuster. And here to discuss Blockbuster's struggles and their eventual demise is Alan Payne. Alan is the author of the fantastic book, Built to Fail. It comes out March 9th and chronicles Blockbuster's growth in the late 80s and early 90s, all the way to their eventual bankruptcy and the closure of the vast majority of their retail stores. He spent over 31 years in the movie rental business, 25 of those with Blockbuster. While with Blockbuster, he oversaw one of the most successful Blockbuster franchise chains in the country, most of their stores, Alaska and Texas. And in fact, his final Blockbuster store closed fairly recently in 2018, well after the majority of the Blockbuster stores in the country shuttered. Alan, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here to talk about this.
First, just so we can establish a bit about your background, you didn't start at Blockbuster. So I was wondering if you'd mind talking a little bit about your pre-Blockbuster career and then how you ended up at Blockbuster.
Yeah, I spent 15 years with a company called HEB Grocery Company, which if you're from Texas, you know about them. If you're outside of Texas, you may not know. But anybody that's in the retail business has heard of them. They're widely regarded as the best grocery company in the country and one of the best retailers of any kind. So I was fortunate that I got to learn the retail business from them. I kind of fell in love with retail early on just because of the excitement of it, the immediacy of it. And about halfway through my career there, this was in the mid 80s, they decided to get into the video business. And it wasn't just the in-store departments, which most people are familiar with, that the supermarkets did back then. We opened a chain of freestanding video stores called Video Central. And they were comparable to Blockbuster, the Blockbusters of the day in size. We ran the business very much differently than them. And we were very successful against them. And I think the most important part of that story is that HEB was really the only major retailer that entered the video rental business. It was a business that was primarily founded by small entrepreneurs and eventually Blockbuster, of course, which was Wayne Huizenga, who founded that company, was really an entrepreneur, but one on a much larger scale. But HEB was the only really developed retail operating company that got into the business. And I think that was a large part of why we were so successful against Blockbuster. And then I left there when Charles Budd, who owns HEB, decided that he wanted to get out of the video business. And we never really understood totally why. I think he just wanted to make sure that 100% of the focus of HEB was on the grocery business. So he sold the stores, and that's when I left and joined a Blockbuster franchisee, and that was in 1993.
And when you were at Video Central, one of the things you note in the book is that from the outside looking in at Blockbuster, you noted some weaknesses in terms of their growth, in terms of their system. When you became part of that Blockbuster fold, so to speak, what were some of the ways you really noted in which Blockbuster might have struggled to keep up with some of those local or regional operators, at least the ones that they didn't buy out?
One thing I noticed right away is that, you know, coming from a company like HEB, we were so focused on competition, regardless of how large they were. And it's a cutthroat industry, as you know, and you pay attention to everybody and you pay attention to detail. And I think everybody in the grocery business knows that if you're going to succeed long term, you've got to be totally focused and just passionate about the business. When I got to Blockbuster, what I found was there was no passion about the business. There was passion about opening stores and making money, but there didn't seem to be a whole lot of interest in understanding the details and intricacies of how the business worked. And even though I came from a company that was a grocery company, I got to Blockbuster expecting that they would have developed their management information systems better than we had in a grocery company. What I found is that they hadn't. That most of the information that I was used to having ready access to run the Video Central stores at HEB, Blockbuster didn't have them. Their entire back office management system was unbelievably archaic. And I had to find ways to work around it to get the data that I needed to run our stores, our franchise stores. So that was the most revealing part, and that they had no interest at all in the way we ran our stores. And we knew that they were extremely successful against Blockbuster because, as I say in the book, we got the information out of their trash. We knew how we were doing against them. And we knew that the stores that Blockbuster had that were competing against us were doing about half of their average. And we were doing 2 to 3 times more sales than they were. But I later find out that they had themselves convinced that we weren't making much money because we were a grocery company. They thought that we were making about 2 or 3 cents on the dollar, which was completely bogus. I just found a company that was, you could call it arrogant, you can call it hubris, you can call it a lot of things, but they just didn't have much interest in the business and whatever anybody else thought about the business. They didn't want to know anything about how we ran the business at HEB. And as it turned out, the company that bought our stores at HEB, because Blockbuster wasn't interested, turned out to be Hollywood Video. Hollywood Video had copied our business model. They only had about 15 stores at the time they bought our 30 plus stores at HEB. They took the company public and within about 5 years had opened almost 1,000 stores, and Blockbuster was cash flow negative. And that really was Blockbuster's first big miss. The later misses were Netflix and Redbox and all the others that most people are most familiar with. But that miss was in the early 90s when they could have learned everything that they needed to know about Hollywood Video because they ran the same business we did, but they just totally ignored what we were doing.
I want to go back to something that you mentioned there, which is that, again, Blockbuster's sales growth was spurred almost entirely by developing new stores. Sales at existing stores in decline well by the mid-1990s.
Right.
And you mentioned in the book about the idea that they were built for growth that makes it look pretty on a balance sheet when you're growing that revenue year over year. But you mentioned that they were built for growth, but not much else. I was wondering if you could expand on that a little bit.
Well, I think it's the proof is in how they reacted to their competition. I think maybe this is important to note that the video rental business, it kind of peaked in the late 90s. There was very little growth left, and everybody knew that eventually electronic delivery would start to erode the in-store business. But all along the way, as the business was flattening out, Blockbuster was still opening thousands of stores. So I think the proof comes in really of their behavior. The Blockbuster store of 1996 and 1997 looked almost the exact same as the ones that opened in 1985. There was virtually no difference. They hadn't really tried to make a better store, they just opened more, even though the industry that they were in was relatively flat. You couldn't engage Blockbuster in a discussion of how to change their stores and make them better. They just wanted to open more of them. And I guess what's fascinating is they went through 5 different CEOs during that time frame. And all of them did basically the same thing. All of the growth of Blockbuster came through after, as you mentioned, the same store growth basically flattened out in the early mid 90s. So all of their growth came by opening more stores, and they were opening those stores and adding billions of dollars in liability, even though they were in an industry that everybody knew was going to be challenged by digital in the very near future. They talked a lot about getting into the digital business, but they really never did anything to plan for it. And they never invested much money in it.
You know, you mentioned the stores that they built basically in the 90s looked roughly the same as they did in the mid-1980s. And that includes the inventory. And I learned a ton about video rental inventory dynamics in reading the book, not only in terms of the change from VHS to DVD, but also dynamics in terms of when you get that inventory and the cost of that inventory. You really drove home the point that from the beginning of the 90s, Blockbuster really kind of struggled with their treatment of new and existing inventory versus their competitors. In what ways did this become worse as the chain aged as we got to the turn of the century?
Well, I think it all started with their just lack of curiosity about what customers really wanted. They weren't following the data. They weren't following customer changes. The business was always a lot more about just new releases, as Netflix later proved. But Blockbuster never really understood that. They built a business that was virtually dependent on new releases, yet they weren't even very good at keeping new releases in stock. And of course, in the early days, and what really created late fees was the people forget that most of the movies that we bought for rental in a Blockbuster store would cost $60 to $70. And the demand for those videos, the peak of demand was the first 2 or 3 weeks. So it was impossible to stay in stock on new releases all the time. And that was because of the price that was imposed by the studios. The video stores didn't have anything to do with that. And that's where late fees came from. And of course, late fees have been beat up pretty bad over the years, but it was the only way that we ever figured out to get people to bring movies back. And most people never incurred late fees. It was actually a small minority that did. So Blockbuster never really figured out how to maximize revenue and profit from new releases, which led to some bad decisions down the road. And I think probably the most alarming part of it was when Netflix came along. Netflix, as I say in the book, that Netflix, most people don't remember, Netflix was a buy mail company for the first 6 or 7 years before they got into streaming. They knew that they could not really compete in the new release business because their movies were spending too much time in processing and in the mail. So they built their entire company based on renting older movies. Well, that hit Blockbuster right in their Achilles heel because Blockbuster did not understand, because of their lack of interest in the business, they did not understand that people really wanted to watch those movies. So Netflix built a business by renting about 80% of everything that they mailed to their subscribers were old movies. They figured out early on that if they could market those movies properly, that they were just as good as the new movies of the day. They just had to convince their customers that they were. Blockbuster never understood that. And instead of trying to match Netflix with that, even transitioned the company more toward a new release only business. And of course, well over half of the sales floor was still covered with old movies in the Blockbuster store, but they weren't renting because the selection was poor and the prices were too high. And in the process of a lot of the decisions that they made, their new releases were less in stock and their prices were too high on those too. So they really just made themselves kind of a sitting duck to Netflix. And Netflix just started pulling customers away from them by the millions.
I want to talk a little bit about that pricing structure because you mentioned it. Movie stores were paying in the $65 range for a rental VHS, but when DVDs came along, I believe you mentioned in the book, the average price for those was around $17, which in turn drastically changed the pricing structure. How did DVDs influence the overall financial dynamics of movie stores, and how did Blockbuster as a company, not necessarily your stores, because your stores seemed to adapt very well at that point, but how did Blockbuster fail to adapt to the overall DVD influence?
Well, I think it's probably the most important part of the whole Blockbuster story because the business model completely changed from VHS to DVD. VHS was treated as a rental product, which meant that most of the new releases were sold for $40 to $60, $70. And that created what was known back then as the rental window. In other words, customers, Walmart wasn't going to buy those movies to sell in their stores because nobody's going to pay $100 retail for them. So they wound up in Blockbuster stores before Walmart got them. And usually we had them for rental for at least 4 or 5 months before Walmart would get them to sell. When DVD came along, everything was for sale. So Walmart and all the other retailers in the country immediately became direct competitors with cheaper product. It was not unusual to go into a Walmart and see new releases for $20. And I think probably the biggest mistake that Blockbuster ever made in that time frame anyway, was their failure to recognize that they had to aggressively change the company, transition it from VHS to DVD. They never did that. Their inventory in DVD was always smaller than it was in VHS, which I never could understand. So what we wound up with is a Blockbuster store, all of their older movies were still about $4 to rent, and they didn't have very many of them. And you could go to a Walmart and buy them for $4 or $5. So that was something I never could understand why Blockbuster didn't get that. So at that point, you had Netflix renting these older movies to their now millions of subscribers, and Walmart and every other retailer in the country selling them at low prices. Blockbuster never took the step to compete with either of those on the older movies, which was one of the things in our stores we aggressively did, and we did it very successfully, and that's what kept us going. So I think that was the biggest miss, and one that was really missed by, you know, Wall Street. Blockbuster was a public company back then, and it was frustrating to me that analysts would look at the business and attribute Blockbuster's decline to all kinds of things. But to me, it was a fundamental thing that they didn't even have their inventory right as it transitioned from VHS to DVD.
It's a good point there regarding analysts, and something that we often drive home on the show is that analysts don't always get the full picture of things or have a full grasp even of the industry. I want to go back and hit on something you mentioned, because you mentioned Walmart and every other retailer essentially became a direct competitor because they're selling videos at approximately the same price that Blockbuster is renting. Blockbuster had this idea that they were going to edge their way into the DVD sales space as well. And I think the explanation for why this didn't go as well was a fascinating one. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about why Blockbuster's foray into DVD sales didn't go as well.
I had the benefit of seeing it from both sides from all the years I'd spent at HEB. I make the point in the book, if we could sell more movies off of a check stand than Blockbuster could ever sell out of a store. The whole dynamic of how movies were treated in retailers, they were basically loss leaders. Walmart wasn't trying to make money off of selling Lion King or whatever. They were selling it usually at cost. Blockbuster would have to match that price in order to gain market share, which didn't make a whole lot of sense. And the main reason was this. Most people go to a video store at that time once or twice a month. They go to grocery stores every week. And that's where they go to spend their money. So you go to Walmart or your local grocery store and those movies are in your face at cost. Why would you make a special trip to go to Blockbuster and pay $2 or $3 more for it? Because Blockbuster was always going to have to sell it for a little bit more to make any money off of it. And I rightly so chose not to do that because it wouldn't have helped the business at all. Blockbuster could not generate traffic off of selling movies at cost. Those people were going to grocery stores already. And over the years, Blockbuster finally learned that the sell-through business was going to be in the hands of the major retailers. It was never going to be a Blockbuster store.
As the book goes on, a main theme of it is that Border Entertainment, or the franchisee, that, of course, that you oversaw, made some strategic decisions that kept your stores not only just afloat and surviving, but profitable, in fact, and profitable far longer than most Blockbuster stores that were out there. I think the purchase of the Rio Grande Valley stores in 2006, we kind of talked about before recording this interview, certainly illustrated that. What were some of the strategies that enabled your stores to thrive as you got into the 2000s?
Any retailer listening to this would think, okay, if your cost of product declined by 60%, you would think that was a pretty good thing. And that's basically what happened, is that from paying $50 plus for a new release movie, we were paying $17. The studios did that because they thought they could move most of the rental business to sales. Well, that didn't happen. If the rental business was run right, the demand for rental was just as high with DVDs as it was for VHS, but it had to be done right. So what we had the opportunity to do was buy at least twice as many new releases, charge less for them. The availability was much better, and it attracted more customers to the business. And then on the catalog side of the business, we had Netflix out there pulling customers to basically watch older movies. We increased the size of our inventory and catalog by about 4 or 5 times over what it was in VHS. Blockbuster did the exact opposite. Theirs was smaller and it was priced higher. We saw it as an opportunity to attack Netflix's weaknesses, which we knew was new releases. And then on the catalog, what we did is that we couldn't have everything that they had, but we had everything our customers asked for. We had a program called We've Got It or We'll Get It. Sounds simple, but it was powerful because any customer that walked into the store and asked for a movie that we didn't have, we bought it and put it in the rental inventory. So some of our stores had inventories that were 6-7 times larger than a typical Blockbuster store. And they were renting just as much. They were turning. They weren't sitting. They were turning. I make the point in the book about one of our stores in Anchorage, Alaska, that was renting over 10,000 catalog movies a week. That was about 3 times more total movies than a Blockbuster corporate store was renting every week. So that kind of illustrates the difference. We looked at DVD as an inexpensive way to create a better business. And that's what we did. And I think it's highlighted by the fact that during that time frame that Blockbuster was really going into a permanent decline that led to their eventual bankruptcy, we went at the business completely differently and tripled our profit in the same period of time. And it's not because we were doing anything magical. We were just following the customer and studying what needed to be done and doing it aggressively. Blockbuster went the exact opposite way, and instead of tripling their profit, went bankrupt during the same time period.
As we wrap things up here, I wanted to go kind of full circle here. One of the first things you mentioned in the book is that so often stories of failed retailers or failed companies even in general are told by those that were in charge or in the C-suite at said retailer. And the problem with that is these executives often are attempting to maybe protect their own legacy for one reason or another. Maybe they want other positions. So they're not entirely transparent about everything that transpired on the way down with a particular retailer. Why did you feel it was important to tell this story about Blockbuster?
I think that what motivated me to tell it for the most part, I believe, was if you ask anybody today why Blockbuster failed, most all of them will tell you it was Netflix, of course. And by Netflix, they usually mean Netflix, the streaming business. And what I want everybody to understand is that Blockbuster was in deep, deep financial trouble even before Netflix was founded. And it was in much more trouble before Netflix ever streamed a movie. So I wanted to make sure that the story got corrected because that's not what happened to Blockbuster. Blockbuster did not fail because Netflix beat them with streaming. Blockbuster was a broken company before Netflix ever streamed a movie. So I really believed I was in a unique position to tell the story because I was there for virtually the entire life of the company. And in a franchise company, the franchisees get a unique opportunity to see the insides because we're running the same business they are. And anytime they do something different, we get a window into what their thinking is and why they're doing it. And I'll say this, the franchise group, we always had a productive working relationship with Blockbuster. They were open about what they were doing, why they were doing it. In the case of our company, we just didn't agree with much of anything that they did. But we always had a good dialogue about it. So all those years that went on, I got a real good understanding of how they ran the business. And I can remember not much more than just frustration at how they did it. So it was real illuminating to me to go back after all those years and try to connect all the dots. And it became pretty clear that it could have been a much different story had Blockbuster approached the business differently. And I think probably the best way to illustrate that is that Netflix, when they started, they were renting DVDs too. They were just doing it through the mail. And Netflix was never as big a company as Blockbuster renting DVDs. Blockbuster was multiple times larger than Netflix ever became in renting DVDs. Yet Netflix is the one that successfully transitioned renting DVDs to streaming. Blockbuster was a much, much bigger company doing the same thing through stores. Why couldn't they have transitioned their stores to streaming just the same way that Netflix transitioned their by mail business to streaming? I don't see any reason that Blockbuster couldn't have done that, but they never positioned themselves to do it.
Some great information there. And once again, this interview, this podcast airing March 10th, but book came out March 9th. Where can our listeners find this book that, by the way, highly, highly recommend? I think it's a must read. So where can they go to get this?
Well, thanks so much. It'll be on Amazon and it'll be on every other online bookseller, is my understanding. But, you know, primarily Amazon, but it'll be everywhere else too.
All right. Well, once again, Alan Payne, thank you so much for joining the podcast today. The name of the book, Built to Fail. Great work, and it was great to have you on.
Thank you very much.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We thank Alan for joining us. And my statements about the book, by the way, are not hyperbole. You will learn more about the dynamics of that business and about the decision making of Blockbuster, but also other video chains by reading that book than any other resource. It will give you a fresh new perspective on that sector of retail. And it's something I was lucky enough to get an advanced copy of it, but it's something I highly recommend. And even after I got the advanced copy, I went ahead, ordered myself a paperback version on Amazon because I think it's important to have on the bookshelf to go back to as a point of reference. Now, in our Looking Ahead segment this week, I wanted to look at the topic of restrictions easing up post-pandemic. And we knew this day would come eventually. We knew certain states would probably be before others in terms of rescinding mask mandates. And we saw that from a couple of different states this last week. The most notable is Texas. As of today, there is no state mask mandate in Texas there. And this resulted in a handful of statements coming out from grocers and other retailers, Kroger, Albertsons, certainly primary among them. And I liked Albertsons' statement because it was almost passive aggressive. They basically said, and I'm going to quote this directly from the statement, "Our frontline associates have not had full access to the vaccine. Subsequently, our stores and facilities in Texas will continue to require masks for associates, vendors, and customers, regardless of the mask mandate being lifted." Sounds like, again, they're a little bit salty at a lot of retail associates not being one of the first in line to get vaccinated there. But this does bring an interesting point because you hear people on both sides of the argument, certainly, and we're not here to argue whether mask mandates are a good thing or a bad thing. We're going to leave that to the people that actually have some semblance of medical expertise, which neither Layton nor I do. But the reason I'm looking ahead to this is we're going to see states gradually roll back the mask mandate, especially probably in the South and the Midwest first. How do retailers adjust to that? At what point do retailers make decisions? And is it going to be locally based? Is it going to be percentage of people that are vaccinated? Is it going to be once their store associates are vaccinated? If it's once the store associates are vaccinated, then do you worry about opening yourself up regarding liability if you don't require masks in stores? So there's a lot to unpack here, especially for grocers and those essential retailers. So the likes of Walmart and Target. And you'll recall, even in July, there was a period of time where basically no state had a mask mandate in place, and then everyone had a mask mandate in place, it seemed like. But stores were having a really hard time, especially in certain areas of the country, enforcing this. And there were a lot of issues. There was a lot of pushback against store associates. I actually saw an incident this past weekend in a rural area where a Walmart employee asked a customer to put a mask on, and the customer refused and literally sprinted by the Walmart associate, which seems like it would be easier just to wear a mask than have to sprint by Walmart associates as you're going through the store. But anyway, this is going to be a big decision for retailers, and I think a lot of this is going to have as much to do with liability and PR as it will the actual safety of their employees. Not saying they don't care about the safety of their employees, but they certainly do care about the other things. And if one chain lifts a mask mandate before another chain, let's say Albertsons lifts one before a Kroger, does that increase business at one or the other? We've talked so much during the last few months about how important projecting a message of safety is for retailers. And we've talked to many experts in the field who say that is first and foremost on a lot of customers' minds right now. You'd have to think that maybe given that, unless customer sentiment changes, the last retailer to lift their mask mandate might be in the best position. But again, that's something we'll have to wait on and see. Looking forward, first of all, obviously to the crest out of the pandemic and hoping we can get there quickly and safely, but also just looking forward to how retailers deal with that and so many other issues, so many other things that they've put in place to deal with the pandemic and how they go about rolling those back if need be. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. Again, big thanks to Alan Payne for joining us. Coming up on our next show, which will be about 10 days from now, we're going to be joined by commercial real estate expert Bruce Milton. Now, Bruce has helped a number of companies and a number of real estate firms and landlords broker deals for new locations, among other things. He's going to talk about some interesting initiatives that are happening over the course of the country to try and bring tenants in for landlords. But he's also going to talk about the decision-making process in terms of spotting out a new location and then executing on that new location, both from the real estate side and the renter side, from the retailer side. So an interesting conversation we'll have with Bruce, and we'll look forward to being back with you about 10, 11 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.